right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled. I want to say episode 154. We're coming at you live Tuesday, October 4th.
Happy
in
October.
The year of our Lord 2022. I'm here with the infamous Deborah Z and the notorious Chud X.
That's me.
What's going on, guys?
Oh, a whole lot of everything.
Yeah. Busy time of year.
Busy time of year. It's interesting. Just now I was just picking up Little D from his learning center, and I get just a few minutes of Republican talk radio in. I just was listening to Dennis Prager for like 5 minutes, and guess what he was talking about?
CRT or the trans agenda?
He's talking about libertarians.
Yeah,
and how libertarians are what is wrong with America because they function on emotion, and they only vote to feel good about themselves. But that the only way that you can, if they were to truly be in tune with their emotions, they would be voting Republican because that's the only way they're going to make progress, and that's the way they should feel good, and that they should feel bad if they're voting Libertarian. It was interesting to happen to hear
it
that.
It seems strange because it seems as though there is a concerted, organized effort to put that thought out into the somewhat right of center ether, because what's his name? Steven Crowder had Alex Jones on a couple weeks ago, and Alex Jones pretty much had the same exact argument, and was like talking like, I used to consider myself a libertarian. Now I consider libertarians my enemy, all sorts of stuff like that. Dave Smith did a whole episode retorting to it, you know.
Oh, that's great.
And I kind of agree with the run of the mill right wingers' perspective on that too. Like, I don't think that there's any hope in voting libertarian at this point. If you're still gonna put any, if you're a right winger, I'm a right winger. You know, that's what it is. I mean. Mm-hmm. I could say like, oh, I'm neither left nor no. I'm a right winger. I believe in right wing.
You have a lean.
Yeah, I believe in right wing, the morality of the right wing. I guess I believe in family values and Christianity and stuff like that. And that is inherently right wing now.
So like, I agree with you on a lot of that. But here's the whole thing that gets me, and like why I'm glad that Dave Smith would retort that and whatnot, is because when it comes down to it, it's putting it out in the minds of the voters that you shouldn't actually evaluate these things, that you shouldn't ask yourself what you think you want out of it, that you should play the game and try to use your vote to leverage in different directions. Now, I understand doing that. I'm cool with that. But let's be honest as we do that's all we're doing, that's all we're doing. Not this, I don't know. It gets so thick every year, and the left does it as well. Think about some stuff that was said about Bernie and Bernie votes and things like that. This concept of that anything outside of the two-party system is a wasted vote. Well, I think they're all wasted. To start with, like, I don't think there are legitimate elections.
You don't think even on a local level, there's a legitimate election?
On a local level, I can get down with it.
I'm speaking solely to. I don't put much hope or anything in like a presidential election, because I don't, you know.
Right.
But I think my sheriff, if my sheriff is, or my DA is, you know, a right winger, or someone with, you know, right of center values, it's going to be better than a George Soros appointed DA, you know?
Yes. Yes. And I agree with you, especially on the local level. Dennis was specifically talking about the presidential. He was bringing up the name Trump, like that we need to be focused on Trump, not this libertarian shit. And I assumed that that's what Alex Jones was talking about as well, because people tend to only talk about presidential elections, that the local elections almost don't exist. But then when, so I agree with you 100% when it comes to these local elections, I'm with you. If they're right-leaning, I'd prefer them most likely. But also when it comes to the local level, I kind of feel like my libertarian vote might actually do something if it's a libertarian that I feel that I can get behind, because it's local, you know what I mean? Like I feel like it's less wasted on anything. And if anything, I'm signaling to my community that I exist as an outside thinker. If I don't think, cause like I'd prefer the right-leaning sheriff, but if I'm certain that I'm in a left-leaning county that's going to go left always, my right vote is wasted as well. Is it not? You know, if it's 2/3 against 1/3, and it really is that way around me, then I'm wasting my vote with anything other than the winner. Does that make sense?
Sort of a fatalist approach to it, though, isn't it? I mean, unless you're gonna like get your whole community together and ask them how you're voting, because I don't want to waste my vote. That's kind of fatalist, isn't it?
I would say so. Yeah. But I mean, if we're saying fatalist, meaning like, you know, that there is no win. Is that what you mean by fatalist?
Yeah.
I don't see myself as ever having to win around here. And if I do, it's like, I don't think that I'm actually swaying that. I don't think I as an individual have really anything to do with that. But like I will vote locally for sure. But it doesn't seem to hold a whole lot of weight.
Yeah. At this point, I was also telling this to Emily, we were talking, there's a contested sheriff's election coming up, and there's the incumbent who I'm going to vote for because he was fantastic on lockdowns. And and then I look up the guy that's running against him, who has a lot of support as well. I think he was just campaigning a lot more earlier because he's not the incumbent, so he probably had to campaign more. But I'm seeing up now a lot of signs for the incumbent, Pixley. And what, you know, every time I look at this, the guy that's running against the guy that's already sheriff, I'm a one topic voter. A lot of people are like, you know, like Monica Perez talks about, like her mother all the time is a one topic voter, which is abortion. Whoever's against abortion, she'll vote for. That's it. I am at this point, where were you on lockdowns and mandates?
Yeah.
And the guy that's running against the guy who was good on it has nothing in any of his website or any of his literature that's available anywhere. I constantly ask him questions on his Instagram page and never get any reply. So I'm voting for the guy that I know is already good. What was your policy on mandates? If you were bad on COVID in any way, and unfortunately this goes down all the way down the line to people I know that aren't running for any sort of government position. If you were bad on COVID, I will never listen to anything you say again, i.e. Yeah. Scott Horton.
I get that, Adam. Let me ask you this though, in this unreal scenario here, like, okay, you got one person running you got a right and a left, and they both were bad on lockdowns, but then you got a libertarian who was good on lockdowns, which, you know, if they're libertarian, they might not be, you know, yeah. Like, I mean, that's the thing about all of this is you got to look at you don't just look at the R or the D and make the choice based on that, especially if like you, or I could say I myself am that's a single issue. That is that above all else will sway my vote if I'm voting for sure. Vote for the libertarian assuming that, especially in my area or possibly your area, but you know, just because someone puts that libertarian next to their name does not mean they're good on Exactly. Absolutely anything.
But
anything.
I know, especially where I live, the Democrat will never be good on that.
That's
the Democrat will never have safe. Been good on it. The Democrat will have done everything that they've been told to do by the mainstream media and their political affiliation establishment.
It's kind of the MO of that party.
Yeah.
At this moment, in this time.
And that's not to say that millions of Republicans weren't, you know, the exact same way and wearing masks and the elected officials pushing that as well. Governors, all sorts of Republican governors enforce that stuff.
Yes. So big time. And that's where, you know, if you're voting just for the R's, you're probably voting for some people who did and will in the future support things like lockdowns.
Yeah. I guess I have a different outlook on it than you because I am in a vastly different county than where you live. Like it is, and my county is never going to swing. I mean, maybe someday, but as of now, they are building a whole bunch of apartments and stuff in the two larger cities in my county. We're red county. Yeah. So,
and that's great.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic. So,
and my county early in the pandemic, everybody was gung-ho to, you know, get their shots. And now they're saying, they were reluctant to get the shots. And now they're saying, if you're not vaccinated.
They were reluctant about the shots, but were they gung-ho about masks, social distancing, and lockdowns?
Yeah.
And then their reluctancy about any vaccine, I'm sure, was just because it was Trump's vaccine.
Yeah, because we've all seen the reels of every powerful person from the left saying, "Who's going to take this vaccine if it's Donald Trump's?"
Those supercuts cut deep.
Everybody. It's Joe Biden. It's Kamala Harris. It's Nancy Pelosi. It's everybody.
Yeah, just to hear those people. Just months before they said the opposite, saying we can't trust the CDC just because it has approval from the FDA. This is Trump's, you know, I don't know. It was like they're saying all the right stuff in quotes, but then once they had their guy, then it was like you're evil if you question the CDC, FDA, any of the other forms of approval.
But it was still Trump's the whole time.
That's why I hold on to it. I call it the mega jab.
Yep.
You know, I can't remember. Someone told us that here on Into the Apocalypse.
And Randy.
Red Thread, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He said that he was the first person I heard say it like that. And I've held on to it ever since because it's freaking beautiful. And man, you say that to a liberal and you just watch them. The smoke comes out of their ears almost instantly because it just hurts them. It hurts them to process that
mega jab. Is that the
MAGA
term? MAGA.
Make America great again jab.
Okay, so yeah, I don't even know how we got on this whole deal, but if you listen
to the Prager
if you listen to Pete Quinones, I mean, he's my favorite, you know. He's my favorite.
He's got it right, you know. But I don't think what he and Dennis are saying are really the same in a lot of ways.
No, it's not the same.
They sound like the same words. It's similar, but it's such a different message.
Yeah, way different. And Pete's been really putting it down on the libertarians and how it's, you know, just how it's not applicable in real life, you know. So yep. And he just did a recent one with some guy who has some Liberty show from California and did a really good job. And he's reading this book called from the 70s called Race War. And it's about it's a banned book. It costs $600. You can't find it anywhere. And it's written by this teacher who was a teacher at a Brooklyn school that had forced integration in the 70s. And it's like this insane school where there's like 6,000 students and like the teachers are just getting like raped and assaulted. And it's all from, you know, one side of the racial aisle. So you can't get that book anymore. But it's like a Jewish, liberal Jewish guy who wrote it in the 70s, you know, talking about it. And it's just highlighting progressive, you know, forced integration and the issues that it causes. And he's like willing to go on the air and read that. And most people aren't willing to do that stuff. So
absolutely not. They're not.
Yeah. So I've always wanted to get him on the show. So I think I've always been a little intimidated to talk to him just because he's kind of the guy that formed a lot of my political thoughts and or helped me to form them. And then changed with the times and what he saw happening and what he saw as being actually practical and worth fighting for. So,
yeah, Pete's really good. It would be awesome to talk to him on this exact subject.
I'd want to have Deborah on, and then we'd have to like kind of talk about something. I like bringing up people that can bring up topics that happened a long time ago that are exactly the same thing that's happening right now. And I think if we got him on and did Weimar Germany and how it's exactly what happened in Weimar Germany before you know who came into power, mm-hmm. is like pretty much what's going on right now.
We're kind of mirroring all of that right now.
Yeah. And it's just, it's amazing. And that's why history is so important, mm-hmm. you know, because people that don't know history don't know, do you know anything about Weimar Germany, Deborah?
No, I don't.
Yeah. It's, you know, it was Germany after World War One, mm-hmm. before, you know, who came into power before World War Two.
Yeah.
And how their society just crumbled into degeneracy, devalued money.
Yeah. Devalued money is really key.
But it's immorality, and it's all what's going on in the world right now.
They were also dealing with serious issues of gun control during that time too.
Gun control, transgenderism, prostitution, all sorts of stuff like that, you know? So
sounds like what was going on in Berlin. Yeah. Before the war, yep. when, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They had transgender clinics.
I didn't know that.
Doing yeah. what?
Huh?
Doing
hacking people up. Yep.
I'm thinking snippy, so, swap, a little bit of body swap.
Yeah. And then that all that literature, all that history was destroyed. And that's why so many people are upset at. Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why so many people are upset about the people that came into power after that. But I think that's a major, you know, major issue that they have with it, because maybe this is what Pete was saying on his last episode, is if they hadn't got rid of all that literature and that culture, then I'm not saying the religion culture, but if they hadn't got rid of the culture of transgenderism and stuff like what's going on now with it in schools and stuff like that, probably would have been happening in the 60s. They pushed back that cause way far. So I think if we could have someone on and learn about the history of the Weimar Republic and why, you know, people in Portland should watch out, you know, because all that stuff eventually gives rise to, you know, person that
totalitarian powers
everybody thinks is the worst man in all of history, who's a pretty bad guy, but you know, definitely not the worst when it comes down to it. You can point at a lot of communist dictators that were much worse, so
for sure.
Yeah,
those are hard words for some people to hear though.
Yeah, if we're talking body count, so
yeah, if we're talking body count,
we're talking the 6 million or like the what's Mao at?
Oh, it's
200 or something.
Yeah, like 6 million is within the margin of error.
Compared to like Mao or Pol Pot.
Yeah, exactly. Those people.
And then if you just like do national socialism versus communism as a whole, mm-hmm. what do we got there? 1 billion people.
Yeah.
Like, but you're allowed to walk down the street with a communist flag.
Mm-hmm.
Can't walk down the street with the other flag.
Well, you can, but you're not going to get very far.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you can have a commie flag on YouTube. So
yeah, and you cannot do that with the other.
Yeah.
What's the other? What's the other flag?
Swastika.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is that's an ancient symbol too.
Yeah. Pre Hitler.
Absolutely. I've heard more than once that it's, you know, really it's the big wheel in the sky is what that is, because it's supposed to be the North Star with the Big Dipper circling around it.
Isn't it reversed though?
And yeah, because it would go the other direction in the sky. So, and that's the way it was for, I believe, I might be overstepping to say it, but I believe for thousands of years people used that symbol to express the eternity of this realm that we live in. And then he flipped it around the other direction and put it on a flag and on a bunch of armbands. And now that is to never be looked at by humanity again. Or if it is, you better feel real bad about yourself and the people around you, or hate the people who have it, whatever. It's got to have negative feelings associated with it.
Good thing we're not on Rockfin. We'd be kicked off for this talk.
Very likely.
But my friends grew up in, it was like right on the edge of being a mansion, right up the street from where I grew up, this big, beautiful brick house, huge. And it was built in the 1890s. And they had tile on the entryway that was a swastika, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, oh shit. What was it? I just heard something. It was, they're going to rename Swastika Mountain in Oregon.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Swastika Mountain is the name of a place.
Like, yeah. I mean, it's not any sort of big landmark. I think it's just like a hill.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like some guy had it as like his cattle brand before World War II or something like that.
So that was like Swastika Ranch, and that was Swastika Hill or Swastika Mountain.
Yeah. Jesus.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Well, they were debating one of the main thoroughfares through my county. It runs east all the way to the ocean.
Which one? Sir Francis Drake?
Sir Francis Drake. And there was a lot of talk about changing the name of it because, you know, he was evidently a slave owner or, you know. And they did change.
He existed a long time ago.
Yeah.
They did change the name of Sir Francis Drake High School.
They did.
Yeah. They did.
What's it now called now?
It's Archie Miller.
Archie Bunker.
Archie Bunker. I think it's Archie Miller. I'm not sure. He was somebody who was in the Olympics.
One time we played that high school in football, and it was like we won like 60-0, and it was at our home field, and you had to like walk down this like real dark path to get back to the locker rooms. And apparently they had some white kids who thought that they were hard, you know, typical
Marin kids.
Yeah. And they came down the path, we're like waiting outside the locker room, and they started talking some trash to some real live 1990s vatos from my high school who may have been out of high school by that point also. And it didn't turn out very good for them. So They get their butts handed to them. Yeah, in a very, very violent way. Guys, we didn't really get into the business on this one, but you know how to get a hold of us. Deborah Gets Red Pilled at Proton Mail. Hit us on Twitter. Value for Value. Give us donations on Venmo, PayPal. You know, everything is in the show notes. And we have our first affiliate link for a company. So our good friend, Tony Arterburn, I'll get a better read organized for this later on, but our good friend, Tony Arterburn, gave us an affiliate link for his, gold, store, the Wise Wolf, gold and silver exchange. So if you go to DeborahGetsRedPilled.gold, it will get you to his store, Wise Wolf. And from there you can buy all sorts of things, precious metals, crypto, I believe. And he has a new program called the Wolf Pack, where you kind of, it's like a subscription based deal where you just have money taken out every week, and he goes and finds gold and silver for you. And yeah, all the info's at DeborahGetsRedPill.gold. I'll put it in the show notes. And every time anybody buys something from there, we'll get a little kickback. So support Tony Arterburn, our good friend, paratruther, and get your money out of paper and into something that might hold a little bit of more value than these Luciferian bankster notes, as he likes to put it, which are rapidly becoming toilet paper. So yeah, check it out, guys. It's a good plan. But our guest is here, and we got a fun topic today. I'm really excited about this one. Let's just let him in.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Let's see. All right. Admit. Where is he at? Huh. Okay, there he is.
There he is.
Chris Graves, connecting audio. Okay, this is an awkward. Hey, Chris, are you there? He's connecting to audio still. Chris, you there? You got us.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Good. Good to see you, bro. Well, I can't really see you, but we're live. You're on the air. How's it going, man?
Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you?
We're fantastic. We just recently had you on the show. What did we do? We did deep underground military bases and a whole bunch of fun 90s conspiracies.
Yeah, and, the dumbs.
Yeah, we're back with you. And Deborah's here. Deborah, that's Chris.
In the dark there.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
And today we are going to be talking Kurt Cobain.
Yeah.
And all the conspiracies around his untimely death. So. Yeah. Yeah, so for everybody that's didn't hear you the first time around, give them a little info.
Well, I started out researching conspiracy theories probably in the probably the 90s with UFOs, a little bit of JFK, but not so much. I mean, I had heard about that infamous, you know, Bill Cooper tape where, you know, William Greer, the driver for the limo, supposedly turns around and shoots him with like a handgun.
It was a blow dart full of like some sort of sea urchin venom, I think.
That was one variation. Yeah, I remember another one was that the umbrella guy that's standing next to the road sign, he had penguin. Some kind of dart gun too, and the umbrella. So basically Kurt Cobain was one of the first in the years before 9/11 or even Columbine, you know, things like that I looked into later on. So that was pretty much UFOs and Kurt Cobain, now I think about it.
Yeah.
And later on, I ended up becoming a fan of, you know, writers, researchers like Dave McGowan. And like I said, Bill Cooper. I was never really a big follower of Alex Jones for different reasons, but I did watch and see what he was up to, you know, when he started rising up the ranks. Then 9/11 happened, and that pretty much changed my life, like pretty much a lot, you know, most folks, I think. And I've been keeping track of that event even to this day. You know, anything I can find that was either reported on the day or, you know, found out years later. And I started sending research to an author by the name of Donald Jeffries, who wrote the book Hidden History. And he kind of came around the time that, you know, Jesse Ventura was putting out books, and like I said, Dave McGowan and his research while he was still alive. I've pretty much stayed with Donald, you know, by his side, basically. A lot of my stuff ended up in Hidden History 3, which he's trying to get published right now. He's also working on a pandemic book that was actually the first thing I started sending him research on, and that was like right when the lockdowns happened in March of 2020. So I started finding him articles from like all over the world that a lot of Americans weren't really privy to, either because they weren't looking or, you know, they didn't know to look. So
yeah, and you have a special knack for being able to, despite
find
being
thing, yeah
despite
find
being
things
a that... technical Luddite, as you call yourself, you are able to find some stuff that a lot of people have trouble finding, and you're able to send me a ton of links. I really appreciate it. You send And then you send Tony Arterburn, who we were just talking about, a ton of links, and Don Jeffries. And those are two of the best guys in the game. So
I apologize for that. Actually, a big part of that is my OCD.
Like, yeah.
And I feel like I need to share it with as many people as I can when I come across things. Because, you know, I'm not in this to make any kind of money, because I'm not making any money. And I look at it as kind of like a public service, not to sound, you know, too superhero-ish. But if that's a way of waking people up to the corruption that goes on, then I guess, I guess it's, in a way, it gives me some kind of purpose. So,
yeah, I really appreciate it. Coming up when Billy Ray Valentine gets his channel up and running, Deborah and I are going to do like a weekly kind of current events show. So
that's fantastic.
I will definitely be using your stuff that you send me. So
yeah, please keep
sending it over. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's going to be called Unhinged with Deborah and Adam.
I love it.
But Deborah, were you a Nirvana fan?
I appreciated Nirvana.
Yeah, I was, you know, at that point in time, I was, my sister was a big grunge rocker. You know, we grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and she was 3.5 years older than me. So in 91, when Nirvana broke with Smells Like Teen Spirit, I was 12. So I think it came out in the fall of 91. I remember being at
September. Basketball. Yeah, almost September 11th, 1991, almost 10 years before 9/11.
I remember being at basketball practice and just like everybody singing it, you know. And at that point, you know, I was 12 years old. I was listening to Guns N' Roses. That was also in like, because the Black Album had just came out, Metallica. Use Your Illusions 1 and 2 had just come out. And Metallica and GNR did that big tour. And those
Faith
were probably,
No More.
Yeah, I love Faith No More too. Those were two of my, Metallica was my favorite. And I like Guns N' Roses after that too. I'd been a big GNR fan since I was a little kid, you know, but at the same time, I listened to a lot of Ramones and a lot of like early punk rock stuff that I didn't even know was called punk rock. You know, I liked the Dickies and the Ramones at that time.
Yeah.
But my sister was listening to Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, and I hated those, all that like Mudhoney and Melvins. I didn't like any of that stuff.
Please tell me, please, just for my own peace of mind, tell me you didn't have any problems with Alice in Chains, did you?
I might have liked them at the time. I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan now. I always liked Nirvana, and even to this day, I still enjoy Nirvana, and I never really considered them like a grunge band on the same level as like Pearl Jam. I don't see how those two bands are considered the same genre, you know, just because they're kind of from the same area at the same time.
They both wore flannel in the same period of time in the same city.
That's all it took.
Yeah.
Same Chud, with Alice in Chains.
Chud,
and
you're,
all of that.
You were from the Pacific Northwest too. What was, you know, when the Nirvana broke in 91, do you have a recollection of that? You're a little younger than I am.
I was a little younger, but I hung out with cool older kids. I was very aware of Nevermind when it came out. You know, that was my next door neighbor had that cassette, and that was like all that we played, and I loved it. Although it was in that very short time, feels like a long time when you're a young kid, but in those couple of years between that and by the time In Utero, was that the next one?
They had Incesticide like right in between.
Was that in between?
Like, and yeah. Bleach before that, right?
Yes, yep.
I remember by the time In Utero came out, I kind of hated all of that Seattle scene.
Yeah.
100 miles south of where I lived, and everyone was, you know, like, I grew up wearing flannel because that's what you wear
when you're in the Pacific.
And all of a sudden, they started releasing these ones that had hoods on them and stuff. And I was like, suddenly I won't wear flannel. I hate grunge rock. You know, I was just kind of I was really into the heavy metal stuff, and I really like telling everyone that shit's pussy, you know, kind of a thing.
Oh yeah, we've talked about it. Hopefully this is no offense to you, Chris, but the worst of them all was Stone Temple Pilots.
Oh yeah, I hated no them. We all called them the cloned Simple Pirates.
Yeah,
because we just thought they were there. Oh, we got to tack another band on to the end of all of this, and they're not even from Seattle, right?
Yeah,
I don't know. It was
they were from San Diego, I think. Yeah.
I have a much more open mind when I look back on all of that music now, and I can sort it out a lot better. At the time, for me, it had a lot more to do with who listens to what,
right,
and what did you wear, and you know, crap like that. And I have much more respect for pretty much all of those bands, even maybe Stone Temple Pilots, I guess, if I were to look at them, but I don't even really look at that stuff too much. But yeah, so I was very aware with it, but aware of it. I was very opinionated by it by the time Kurt Cobain died, which I vividly remember finding out about, because I was at the mall.
And, yeah, I was at the mall too.
And I was with my cousin, and he was ordering food in the food court. And
Orange Julius or the hot dog on a stick, or
I believe it was Steak Escape.
Sparrow.
but yeah, the person there like couldn't take his order because they were so upset because Kurt Cobain had just died. And I was, like I said, I was rebelling against all of that stuff. So I was like, yeah, fuck that guy. You know, like my immediate reaction was like I celebrated it in a very uncool fashion.
Yeah.
But you must have appreciated the fact that they killed the glam rock, right?
Yes. That's I was down with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If anything, yeah. I was trying to make a case that Nirvana and Pearl Jam are just glam rock of 1992.
That's what basically. Yeah. That was all record company stuff and PR stuff.
Yeah. Like, what's the street in Seattle with all the clubs on it? I don't know. I've never been there, but that's the new Sunset Boulevard, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
Capitol Hill. Yeah.
I was at the mall in Santa Rosa, California. I told this last time you were on the show, Chris, and I was at Camelot Music buying it. It might have been Sam Goody. I can't remember. It was one of the two.
Wow, and, I remember those.
And yeah, I was buying a In Utero poster for my bedroom.
When you found out?
I did not know. Uh-huh. And so Deborah, the guy, Kurt Cobain had been in Rome and had been roofied a couple of weeks prior and survived the apparent overdose. So the girl goes to me when I'm at the counter, she goes, oh man, it's so sad about Kurt, you know, and I hadn't heard the news yet. And I go, oh yeah, that was a bummer, but you know, at least he's better now. But she was talking about him being dead. I thought she was talking about the overdose a few weeks prior. Yeah. So yeah, that's my remembrance of it.
That was the first real attempt on his life.
Yeah, and then I remember, you know, I got home, turn on the MTV, hear it from, you know, Kurt Loder comes on, starts talking about it. And then remember that guy on 60 Minutes, that old guy, what was his name? Like Andy Rooney? Andy Rooney. He had like some report like the few days after, like talking about.
On his soapbox.
Yeah, yeah, like talking about, you know, how, I don't know.
He didn't know what some he not was
very,
talking about.
Not very nice stuff about it. But okay, so Chris, let's start getting into the funny business of it. When did you start looking into it? What are the first clues? Who first started us talking about the conspiracy, the thought that maybe it wasn't a true just suicide. A heroin overdose and depression or whatever, you know? Or I mean, not heroin overdose is a...
Well, they thought that was overdose, but that was a part of it. Yeah. No, I came across Unsolved Mysteries back in the day with Robert Stack. That music used to scare the crap out of me as a kid.
Great. Dude, I used to watch. I can't remember if it came out on Wednesday night. I think it was on Thursday nights. I would have to. We had like a spooky basement with the TV room in it, like the kids' room. And I would watch Unsolved Mysteries down there. And then we had an unfinished part of the basement where the laundry room was. So I'd have to like run. That part was scary. So I'd have to like get to the run past that to get to the stairs. But yeah, that ending music always spooked me real bad.
Just like with the X-Files music, like they just reminded me of each other. But they had a whole episode about Kurt's death.
And Really?
yeah.
Unsolved Mysteries was still going? Oh, so it was.
This was the original version of it because they've ended it and then brought it back two other
Yeah.
times. I think now it's on Netflix. Like it's
Yeah.
a new thing. But
Huh, I
yeah,
did
the
not
original.
know.
There's
Oh,
new.
There's new. Really?
Yeah, they
Yeah,
redid it.
Netflix. They have like a whole new two new seasons, I think.
It ain't right without Robert Stack.
Yeah, you can
Yeah.
watch. They have the old Robert Stack ones on Amazon.
Yeah. And an actor by the name of Dennis Farina, he took over when Robert Stack died. He took over and like hosted a whole brand new
Dennis
one for
Farina
like
did,
a few
huh?
years.
Yeah, I know who
So
that guy is.
this is a
yeah, he had the
dumb little
mustache.
sidebar, but anybody guys ever seen Amazon Women on the Moon?
Yes, I
No.
have.
There's Robert Stack has a little part. It's like a movie with a whole bunch of short stuff throughout
Like
it.
spoof stuff.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's little spoofs. And there's a Robert Stack part where he's got his show, Bullshit or Not.
Yes,
Right. And
right. Yeah.
he makes a case that that Jack the Ripper was actually the Loch Ness monster.
I tend to believe that still, yeah. There's evidence to corroborate it, but
Okay,
yeah, no,
so
I think Robert Stack was in. Oh, that was a favor he did because he had appeared in Airplane. I don't know if you remember. Yeah, he had a role in that. So he liked doing the spoof kind of thing.
And that was made by the same
Yeah, the
crew as
Zucker Brothers,
Airplane.
I think.
Yeah,
Yeah, and
yeah.
John Landis too, who actually sent me a thing in the mail once, a little Blues Brothers ID card.
Oh, that's
That's
cool.
I
badass.
feel weird about it just because he's kind of responsible for the death of three people on the set of the Twilight Zone movie when a helicopter came out and
Yeah.
decapitated
Oh,
everybody.
yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard
So I
about
feel
that.
kind of weird about it, you know, bittersweet. So,
Yeah.
but yeah, and so there was an Unsolved Mysteries episode. It was 1997, I believe, and it featured this private investigator by the name of Tom Grant, and he was hired by Courtney. In the days before Kurt's body was found, he was hired by Courtney to give the appearance that she was worried about her husband, who had just left the Exodus treatment center in Los Angeles. He kind of just jumped the wall, or whatever, and took off and got a plane ticket and flew back to Seattle.
Yeah.
She
Is
knew
she...
where he was the whole time, by the way.
And she
Um,
was
but.
in LA at that time also, right?
She made sure she was not in Washington State, anywhere near the house. She was at the Beverly Hills Peninsula Hotel, I think. Yeah. So she had a whole plan and everything. Like she had this so-called suicide pact that she came up with, where she was going to tell the press that her and Kurt both, were going to take themselves out at the same time. So she conveniently gets arrested. She has one of her minions, call the cops, and she has, heroin on her in the room. Basically, so it kind of covers her. So it's like, oh, well, she clearly had nothing to do with his death because, she was in LA overdosing herself, that kind of thing. A lot of people don't remember that, but that was reported at the time on like MTV News and things like that. So anyway, Tom Grant is really the key to the whole story because as he was looking for Kurt, he started having like red flags, kind of pop up, especially in the way his employer was acting and the things that she was saying. Like she would appear to be concerned about his well-being and his whereabouts in one moment, then almost like bipolar like. In the next moment, she's complaining about how much money he was giving up by not headlining Lollapalooza '94, which was $10 million. She
Yeah.
kept complaining about money stuff and will stuff, and she was also talking about how she wanted a divorce as well, and she's trying to get a divorce lawyer, a vicious one. So Tom basically started because I guess private investigators are allowed to tape every phone call. And everything. So he started taping all the calls between him and Courtney and all the other people that were surrounding this whole case.
And
So
Tom
he still,
Grant is
yeah.
Tom Grant is a straight shooter. Like he's
Yes.
one of those rare cops who was pro he was a cop before he was a PI, exemplary record, probably like uncorruptible. He actually worked for I think the Los Angeles County Sheriff's
That's
Department.
right. Yep.
And then he worked his way up to detective and then went out on his own and started his own PI firm. And he said he if you want to know about him, go watch Soaked in Bleach. That's him
Yes.
telling the story of this. And it's free on Amazon with ads. But he said he was a successful private investigator because he was able to not ever come at anything with a bias. Like he was just as, he was investigating Courtney Love's story as well as like what, she was trying to get him to prove. So.
Yeah, and later on, he would work on cases for, that had to do with like Bill Clinton and like the scandals and everything, and him cheating and everything. Not so
Yeah.
much the Clinton body count, but basically like the surface stuff, like with Lewinsky and Paula Jones and things like that. So he actually worked for Paula Jones, I think, or yeah, I think it was her attorneys and things hired him to come up with stuff against Bill Clinton. So, he has some pretty high profile. Cases over the years, but he did go bankrupt once or twice, I think, trying to keep this Cobain case out in the public. Because the thing that really drove Tom was he was getting letters from people all over the world saying that had they not come across his website or his interviews on the radio back then, they may have followed suit. And killed themselves like they, because they thought that that's how their hero went out. So basically, that by them saying that to him, he got real teary. He got like teary-eyed and like really almost was in tears on the Alan Handelman show a few years ago, talking about it and how, they a lot of people thanked him because they may have gone the same way. And to this day. Yeah. At originally, it was over 100 copycat suicides worldwide because they thought that's how Kurt had taken himself out. So that was a driving force for Tom. And he has grandchildren and things like that. So, yeah, if you really look into his background, he doesn't really have any dirt whatsoever. And I think I've actually sent him things over the years too, especially about in the around 2008 when Twitter was kind of a new thing. Courtney blocked him and she didn't block me. Obviously, she didn't know who I was. So I was able to actually send some of her tweets to Tom because at around that time, she kept talking about how there was this phantom person that was raiding Frances Bean Cobain, her daughter, the trust fund that was set up after Kurt died. And come to find out, the most likely culprit was Courtney herself, but she kept talking about how these financial criminals were raiding the trust fund. So all those tweets I was able to send to Tom and kind of have a little bit of like I have with Don Jeffries now, like sending him research. It was kind of like that, but not as extensive. And now I've met Don in person and things like that and come to consider him a friend. But back then it was kind of a similar situation where I would send him things that he wasn't able to get on his own because she blocked him, on Twitter of all things. So I really do think he was, the straight and narrow and, which is a very rare thing, especially in the PI like world. You always hear about these seedy gumshoes or whatever, taking bribes or whatever. But yeah, he seemed to be one of the rare ones.
Did
And
she eventually fire him, or
she
how did?
kept, that's the thing. He wrote her a letter eventually after like 8 months of working for her. And he let her know what his intentions were about getting down to, what happened to her husband. And he basically laid it out and said that, whether or not you are involved, I'm paraphrasing here really badly, but basically he let her know that regardless if whether or not she was involved herself, he was going to continue with or without her cooperation, and that if she wanted to fire him, then he'll understand. But what she ended up doing is she kept him on the payroll even longer, even after going public on the radio for the first time in like January of 90, I think it was December of 94. He did his first radio interview talking about his suspicions and the evidence that he had been collecting, and she kept him on the payroll, almost like keep your enemies closer kind of deal. And she had him go do like kind of mundane like tasks, like go, you know, stake out this heroin dealer's house, this person's house. And it didn't really seem like it, you know, was for anything real, you know, maybe to get dirt on other people possibly, but also to keep him in the loop and keep her in the loop of what, you know, he's doing from day to day, you know? So you would think if someone's accusing you basically of having your spouse killed, you would think that you would want to, you know, fire them. You'd want to take them to court or do something or whatever. But no, she ends up keeping him on the payroll to do all these meaningless tasks for like quite a while after that. And eventually she did let him go. And then she ended up hiring other people to try to get his PI license pulled. She had her lawyers send cease and desist letters to radio hosts. But here's the thing. In the years since it happened, she's never taken Tom to court because that would put her in a position where there would be a deposition type thing. And she doesn't want that because then Tom could actually ask her, you know, things that only him and her would know, like on, you know what I mean? Like she doesn't want to be in that position where Tom, you know, can be a part of the, you know, the attorneys and everything, because he knows things that no one else knows, especially when he taped all those calls and everything. Cause there's a lot of calls that he was able to let, you know, let out basically. So people know that he's serious and he actually has something, but he has a whole lot of other tapes that he hasn't disclosed yet, because he said that if there ever is a legal, you know, a court case, the prosecution is going to need all that stuff. And if he lets all the tapes like be public, then she can have like strategies against, you know, around like certain lies and things she said or did back then. And, you know, so that's a way of preserving like the evidence that if, you know, hopefully one day, because cold cases do get reopened and it's not impossible.
Yeah.
So look at Michael Skakel, that type of thing, you know, Kennedy cousin there, you know, that was a cold case for a long time, but he ended up going to jail, you know?
So Tom Grant was also, he was in contact with her attorney as well, right? And he had all these recorded calls with her. And
Rosemary Carroll, yep.
And she seemed like she was like on his side for a little bit and like saying like, this isn't right. You know, all this stuff is it doesn't coincide. She's lying. She's telling, Courtney Love is telling all these lies and things like that. And then at a certain point, she finds out that she's being recorded. And yes. Like says that she can't talk about it anymore, right?
Yeah, basically she goes, "Oh, come on, Tom." And then it just like, and he goes, "Well, do you want me to stop recording?" And then she goes, "Yeah." And then she goes to say something else, and it just like cuts off. But all of her conversations, for the most part, were on the phone were recorded. So
yeah, because she at one point she says, "Am I being recorded?" And he says, "I record every one of my calls."
Yeah, and she's like, "Oh my God." She's like, "Oh God." So she was actually the one, oh, I got delayed anyway. Yeah, she was the one that actually was pushing him to go further with it. Because originally he was content with it being basically a suicide. And he even says that on the calls. He goes, "Well, I think maybe you might be wrong about that. I think it could end up that he really did, you know, just kill him." So, you know, he's actually telling her that he thinks that it's possible that he just killed himself. But then with her being the way that she is, and you can hear all these tapes, like either on CobainCase.com, that's Tom's website, or even in the movie Soaked in Bleach, a whole bunch of them are in there. You can hear her persistence. Like she's like, "He wasn't suicidal, Tom."
Yeah.
Because she was the one that told Tom that Kurt had called her up and asked to have Courtney taken out of his will, and that he wanted a divorce. And then at the same time, she said that Courtney called her around the same time and asked her to find the most vicious divorce lawyer that she could find. So Rosemary Carroll, who was, by the way, was Frances Bean's godmother, her and her husband, Danny Silver, they were both Frances Bean Cobain's godparents. After that, Drew Barrymore became Frances Bean's godmother. Not
Oh
Rose
yeah,
McGowan.
I remember that when Drew, right when Courtney Love turned from like the gnarly grunge chick into she tried to become like a hot
Hollywood
chick.
starlet.
Actress,
Yeah, that's she was running around with Drew Barrymore and like Pamela Anderson and stuff, right?
The People versus Larry Flynt, she had a role in, and then later
Yeah.
on, Man on the Moon, the Andy Kaufman movie.
She is all a strange case, and
Yes.
she's been around for a long, long time. I tell people go back, I think to sometime in the late spring of 2019 on Tinfoil Hat. So it would have been like April or May on Tinfoil of 2019. If you go back in the archive, they had a guy come on to talk about Courtney Love. I was going to listen to it again for it's one of the best Tinfoil Hats I've ever heard.
Was it John Potash, the guy who wrote the book about the
Drugs.
CIA drugs used as a weapon against us?
Yeah, it might be that guy.
I think that's who
I
it
talked
was.
to
I
him.
kind of want to listen to that again too. That
Yeah,
was I talked to him on Don's show actually when I called in,
Yeah.
and I asked him what he thought like about possible suspects. And he does good work, don't get me wrong. And he kind of takes up the mantle of like the late Dave McGowan in that whole like entertainment industry being mixed with military intelligence type of scenario.
Yeah.
But he, me personally, since I've been, I don't really give myself any credit like ever for anything, believe me. But I've been researching this case like for pretty much since like the mid 90s. And I don't know how long Mr. Potash has been researching it, but he kind of bought into this hoax that was put out there of a guy named Alan Wrench
Yeah.
that I actually confronted who most likely was the real person to put the gun in Kurt's mouth, and that wasn't Alan Wrench.
So tell
So
the story of Alan Wrench. He was like some gnarly punk rocker from LA who was supposedly hired by Courtney Love to he says he was hired by her and did it.
well, basically, it goes back to like the movie Kurt and Courtney from 1998.
Yeah, which is
And
has
but
all sorts of stuff that's
oh
proved
yeah.
wrong in it, right?
Well, yeah, I mean Nick Broomfield, the British guy, the filmmaker, he had the right idea, but I think he kind of lost steam like at a certain point, and he kind of turned the movie into a First Amendment issue kind of thing, especially
Yeah.
with the ending taking place with Courtney receiving an award for like basically for free speech and things. And then the filmmaker himself, Nick Broomfield, goes up on stage right before Courtney can talk, give her a speech, and he says how offended he is about how the this organization could in good conscience give her any kind of an award based on the fact that she had threatened so many reporters over the years with violence and like their lives and things for because they would report unflattering things about her and stuff. So it's kind of ironic. But yeah, like when it comes to like the morphine that was in Kurt's system and everything, he got that totally wrong. And then
Yeah,
in so
because he said the amount of morphine or heroin or whatever he was on when he shot himself was like something real weird, like four
Well,
times what would.
he used the example of someone that was taking methadone
Yeah,
orally, I
he
believe.
used methadone
Yeah.
as the measurement instead of pure heroin, as the heroin that Kurt Cobain would have been on.
And
And
Drew
like he shows a
Baynesley, yeah.
guy like drinking that
Standing on
much
his one
heroin and
leg.
standing on one
Yeah.
leg saying, oh, he could have done it.
Yeah, and that wasn't a good correlation. So in Soaked in Bleach, I believe there's a scene where they correct that.
Yeah.
But they had the right idea that there was, at the time, there was a conspiracy theory that Kurt Cobain could have been murdered. That was the whole thing. So there was this sleazy, I mean, there was this punk rock guy that went by the name of El Duce.
Yeah, from the
His real name
Mentors.
was The Mentors, and they considered themselves,
Eldon something.
Eldon Hoke was his real name.
Yeah.
Yep.
They considered themselves the leaders of the rape rock
Yeah, rape
movement.
rock.
They
Yeah.
coined the phrase.
They
Can you
coined the
believe
phrase.
that? Can you believe that? No one else said it before them.
I
They would go
saw.
on like Geraldo and things like that. They'd go on like the trashy tabloid like
Well,
talk
they were
shows.
on everything in the 80s was doing
Yeah.
that, and they'd have like
I've
Gigi Allen
Yes,
and
exactly.
El Duce on and stuff like that. They were
I
always
first
on.
heard the Mentors on the Jerry Springer show.
Yeah, yes. Before that they were,
and I didn't think they were real. I thought they were. It was like a fabricated thing because they're up there saying we play rape rock and all that.
Yeah.
Well, if you hear him behind the scenes and other things, he's totally just like he's a drunk. He doesn't really believe the stuff.
Oh, he was real bad off, man. Like Morton, that guy. I actually worked for years with a guy who grew up down the street from him
because they're from Seattle, right?
Originally, they were, but this guy was down. He grew up in L.A.
Okay.
And he was 10 years younger than El Duce. So when he was an early teen, the mentors were practicing down the street from him in a garage. And his older brother like became friends with El Duce. And he kind of blames both he and his brother's alcoholism on El Duce. So how you like that?
Yeah, I saw like the 2014 rendition of the Mentors in Oakland. Oh,
they kept going. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah, they're still playing shows right now. There's a real bad, you know, they have those real bad music documentaries on Amazon. There's one about the Mentors.
Wow.
But yeah, like I have a friend that saw them with El Duce in Boston. My friend Jeff is from Rhode Island. He said he was at the Rat, which is a famous punk rock club in Boston, and he said like they were there, they heard a big crashing noise, they went outside, the Mentors had crashed their van into the Rat, came in, played the band, like whoever was like the local house band, they've used their instruments, played like four songs, smashed the other band's instruments and left. That was his experience seeing the Mentors.
The Mentors were really just really bad drunks. Like yeah. that's the way I can see them when I look at that. You look at any old footage of them, interviews or them playing. They weren't even clever with anything they were doing. They were just really, really wasted always.
Yeah. Their do you know what their most famous song of all time was, Deborah?
I don't even know who the Mentors
it
were.
Is, so. It is called Donkey Dick.
Donkey Dick, that's
oh,
right.
Great. And, the course is,
I've got a great big donkey dong. It's over 15 inches long.
I'm sure and this is going to help you watching Jeopardy one day.
There is a scene from the PMRC hearings. Remember those? Like the Tipper Gore hearings? Where
D. Snyder comes in.
Yeah, I can't remember who it is, but someone has some like congressman or something like it reads those lyrics. It's like it's pretty funny. Yeah,
Frank Zappa made them do that. I think it was Tipper Gore.
Tipper Gore read them. Yeah,
had to read them, and it busted the entire courtroom into laughter. They couldn't stop laughing as she was trying to read it, and that was like kind of a key pin to be pulled, because it was like, this, you're gonna say this isn't comedy. We're making a serious courtroom bust out and laugh yeah. during the lyrics, and you're going to try and tell us this is influencing kids and isn't humor, you know.
And then wow. the other part of that was D. Snyder coming in looking like a rocker and everything,
yeah.
and then going on and speaking pretty eloquently about yeah. like how this is all like BS, and you know, I don't know, I can't remember exactly, but he was almost speaking like a lawyer, and you should have saw like the all the people's faces and everything. Like they were expecting him to bury himself, you know, like with yeah. his testimony.
So the story is, Deborah, that so in Kurt and Courtney, which is like the first movie that came out about it, did you ever get a chance to watch that one?
It's not, I couldn't find it anywhere.
Yeah, I watched it a long time ago, and they make a pretty good case, but they show El Duce in it, and mm-hmm. at one point, I don't know how they got to that, to going and finding him, but they find him at some house in like San Bernardino. He's like not well, doing
the
well.
The backstory that Mick Broomfield doesn't go into is like, you know, his El Duce's introduction to the whole thing, which was that he made the claim that Courtney Love offered him $50,000 to whack her husband, Kurt Cobain.
Yeah.
And when he made that claim, Tom Grant got involved in everything. He to this day, he doesn't know really what the El Duce, you know, aspect of it really means, but he didn't discount it at first. He actually paid the guy who did the lie detector test for O.J. Simpson, the one that O.J. like famously like failed big time.
Yeah.
He paid for that guy to give El Duce a lie detector test. And El Duce like passed for like 99%, 99 point something something percent certainty that he was telling the truth.
And he said so that, in the lie detector test that he was contracted to kill him.
It was basically, it gave him like the credibility, like besides his background being, you know, the mentors.
Yeah.
It gave him and the fact that he had a witness too that didn't come up in Kurt and Courtney, the documentary. He had a witness, the music shop, I think it was called. It was on Hollywood Boulevard. It was a record store. That's supposedly the spot that Courtney on New Year's Eve 1993 stopped at and asked El Duce. And the owner or the guy who's worked, the clerk that was working the counter or whatever, he, unfortunately, he was a heroin addict too. So when he was giving, he was doing the lie detector test, he started nodding off. So they couldn't really use, you know, that. But that guy, you know, while he, you know, was not in, you know, intoxicated or whatever under the influence, he had said that he backed up El Duce's claim that because he say he had heard Courtney say that to him, like in the background. So he had a witness at some point, and whether you know, you take that for what it's worth, it was inconclusive because, like I say, he kind of nodded off and during the test. Yeah. And he had a Pakistani, a long name that I can't remember at all, but that didn't come up during Kurt and Courtney. But basically, Nick Broomfield had heard all this stuff because Hard Copy actually covered they actually filmed the lie detector test happening for El Duce. So that was like on Hard Copy at the time. So he and El Duce started making like the talk show circuit, and not so much for the mentors shtick, you know, not doing the rape rock thing, but actually as himself talking about the making this accusation. So Nick Broomfield, cut to 1997, there he's filming the documentary. He's able to find El Duce and interview him like on camera at where he was living in Riverside, California.
Yeah, Riverside.
Yeah, and he said on camera, and you could tell he's like intoxicated. He's like half in the bag, and it's only like noontime, so yeah. He's kind of slurring his words and everything. And he basically says, like, I know, like, I was offered. She offered me to blow his friggin' head off, you know. And yeah. Then he
also says that he'll talk if like they have beer,
if they have
like
enough that. Beer for him. Yeah. So it's, yeah. that does a lot more talking, you know, the whole money thing. But then he lets something slip out where he goes, well, I know who actually did it. And he says, yeah, Alan. And he cuts himself off from saying the last name. He goes, I'll let the FBI catch him, you know, ha 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 ha. Come to find out there was a guy that he was friends with named Alan Wrench, who was considered himself like a punk rocker and everything. But at the time, Alan Wrench didn't have any money to his name whatsoever, right? Then all of a sudden, the thing that makes it kind of curious is that he's driving around in like expensive pickup trucks. He has like, he had a plumbing business, and all of a sudden he had all this new equipment. He was able to get recording equipment for his band that was called Kill Alan Wrench. And he basically did like the mentors type thing where he just did the shock thing where he didn't deny it. He didn't say it was him, but every time in an interview or something, he would kind of like, he would
play it up.
He would cryptically kind of like refer to, well, maybe there's another like famous rock star that needs to be taken out of the game. You know, things like that, like where he would try to make the person think that, yeah, he was the one that killed Kurt Cobain. But Ian Halperin and Max Wallace, who wrote the books Who Killed Kurt Cobain, which was also a part of the me looking into Kurt's death, besides the Unsolved Mysteries episode, that was a famous book, Who Killed Kurt Cobain, came out in 1998. Then they followed it up with Love and Death, The Murder of Kurt Cobain in 2004. They, in their second book, Love and Death, The Murder of Kurt Cobain, they went and tried to interview Alan Wrench. And the conclusions that they came to were that he was full of it, and that he couldn't have possibly actually done the deed. So, I mean, take that for what it is.
But then we also have Deborah after they interview El Duce for Court.
Oh yeah,
Kurt and Courtney, something like 2 weeks, right? He is
no, two. I think 3 days. Actually.
Okay, 3 days after he makes those claims, He is dies by getting hit by a train, which totally could happen to him, even if, you know, he wasn't taken out by somebody, because he was a stumbling, horrible, horrible alcoholic. If anyone's going
to stumble in front of a train, or even maybe stand up to a train and look at it and say, oh, I can take this on, that's that guy.
Well, yeah, the creepy part about it is that there, one of El Duce's roommates said that he was with another guy that night, and he said that he was going to go out for some beer at the bar or whatever with this guy. And to this day, that roommate has never, you know, corroborated whether it was Alan Wrench or not, you know, but they were friends. And El Duce did say Alan Wrench later on in another video that's like, I think it's still on YouTube. It's like at a party. It's at a house party, and El Duce is like more coherent, and he's not quite, you know, in the bag yet. And he's actually talking about it, and he says Alan Wrench, but it just doesn't, I'm telling you, like the evidence, it just doesn't, because I'm telling you, I'm pretty sure I've confronted the guy who actually did it.
Well, who is it?
There was a nanny that Courtney made Kurt hire.
And that's the guy that's going around with Tom Grant in Soaked in Bleach?
No, that was Kurt's friend Dylan Carlson.
Okay.
And Dylan Carlson, I think, was used by Courtney, you know, for information and, you know, to kind of keep a leash on Kurt and everything. And he's the one that actually bought the shotgun for Kurt, because Kurt had his other weapons confiscated a couple weeks prior, because Courtney made a false claim and called the cops, saying that he barricaded himself in his room and was threatening to kill himself. And when the cops showed up, Kurt was actually out in the backyard smoking a cigarette, and he explained to the cop that I didn't lock myself in there. I was trying to get away from her, like she was all threatening and everything. And I guess the protocol at the time, and maybe it still is that even if there's a claim of self-harm, they have to take away all the weapons on the premises, you know, especially in a domestic thing. They had to take away all of his stomach medication, which was actually keeping him in a pinched nerve. Like, because for years before that, he was using heroin because he was in a lot of pain because he had a pinched nerve that was undiagnosed. So yeah, they took away his pain meds, and they took away everything. So he had to have his buddy Dylan buy the shotgun, not to kill himself, but because he was in fear of his life at the time. Because when they found his body above the greenhouse, above the garage in the greenhouse, his Volvo had all four tires slashed. No one wanted him to be able to get around at all. And that's in the police report too. And there's actually evidence in a Melody Maker magazine from 1994 that states Kurt had contact with the Seattle police on April 2nd. And it was because he was worried about intruders on the property. So you got to think to yourself, is a guy who's in fear for his life suicidal at the same time? I mean, I guess it could be possible, but, you know, the type of shotgun he actually had Dylan buy for him was for home protection, because he had two other shotgun shells in the gun. So why did he have three? Like, did he, in case he missed, like the first time? So, and these were light load pellets too, so they wouldn't penetrate walls and, like, you know, hurt someone on the other side of the wall or whatever, like his daughter or something. So it was basically for intruders, because Courtney had the fence taken down prior to that, and it was like open season. You know, and he didn't even want the house they ended up having to live in. It was, you know, that was Courtney's thing, wanting to live across the way from Bill Gates, you know, up there in Seattle, Lake Washington. So I just said a whole bunch of stuff. So yeah, El Duce and everything, who I actually think, and I think Tom Grant actually thinks too, is that there's this guy named Michael DeWitt who went by the name of Callie, and he was Francis Bean's nanny. And he also was one of Courtney's like ex-junkie boyfriends. So, and he was still using at the time as well, while he was taking care of Francis Bean. He was the only one in the house. And him and he actually had a girlfriend by the name of Jessica Hopper. And she's like a big this big time music journalist now. She ended up getting a position at Geffen Records shortly after Kurt's death. She claimed that she was in the house when Kurt first came back from the rehab in LA and said, you know, she said all kinds of things. And one thing that stuck out was that she said she puked in the driveway as Callie was rushing her away from the scene. And that always stuck out to me. Is like, why would she have that react? Like, what is she reacting to? Did she see the body up in the greenhouse, like after the fact? And to this day, like, there's a video, I think, from a couple of years ago that was on YouTube where someone in a Q&A actually asked Jessica Hopper that question. Like, what was, you know, the last days of Kurt Cobain's life like? Because you were one of the very few people that were in the house, you know, during that time when he was supposedly missing, you know, because Callie actually called Courtney at the Peninsula Hotel and was telling her exactly what Kurt's movements when he was in the house and everything. So why would she feel the need to, on Sunday, April 3rd, call up Tom Grant, this private investigator in Beverly Hills, to go find him when she knew exactly where he was the whole time? So it's like she's covering her tracks and everything. And so basically, Jessica Hopper, during that Q&A, she starts having the crocodile tears, like putting on this really bad act. Like, how dare you ask me something like that? Like, I was really close to Kurt and all this stuff like that. It's been 20 years. I mean, are you really going to start breaking down because someone asked you what was going on in his final days? Like, it's just very odd behavior. And also,
it's very interesting that she goes and works for David Geffen as well, because that guy is a horribly disgusting human being, like one of the
Callie
worst
got a position
pedos
with him too.
Of all time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'd like to
and
know more.
And he's even connected back to like John Lennon's death and everything too, like Geffen. But on a side note, you know, Macaulay Culkin's half older sister was in the house too, because Callie's best friend, Renee, I think, his girlfriend was Jennifer Adamson. Yeah, Adamson, I think. And that was Macaulay Culkin's half-older sister who ended up dying in a weird way in 1999, around the time where this whole case was getting more exposure. So, you know, that was always a weird connection, I always thought, too.
Where was Francis at this time?
Francis was with Courtney at the Peninsula Hotel. So, you know, when she's pretending to overdose and putting on a show for, you know, the media and all these things. Yeah, she was unfortunately, I feel bad for her in a big bad way, just because, like, one of the things I found out is years later, Courtney gave her a Sweet 16 party, right? And you know what the theme was?
What?
Suicide.
Did you say suicide?
Suicide themed Sweet 16 party. You can look that up. That's the real deal, where Francis and all of her friends would be dressed up like you know, dead people that killed themselves.
That's fucked.
Pretty sick stuff. Yeah, and then later on, Courtney actually, there was a case where Francis Bean's husband that she got divorced from, he actually called the cops and everything. There was a whole deal that kind of got forgotten, where Courtney had him kidnapped and almost killed because he wouldn't give back his wedding present, which was Kurt's guitar from the Unplugged in New York.
So she had given it to him as a wedding gift, and when they split up, she wanted it back.
Well, Courtney wanted him to give it back to Francis, you know, or even herself, you know.
Yeah.
And she hired these really seedy Hollywood actors. Actually, one of them was an actor, but Sam Lufty, I think, is one of the guy's names, and he was a private investigator, I think, too.
Wasn't he bullied, like, with Britney Spears or something
Yes, Deborah.
Sorry, I know that fact, but
that's awesome. You're right. Sam Lufty was the guy that was they couldn't get Britney away from.
Yeah,
that was the same guy that Courtney was in business with.
Oh yeah,
kidnap
this guy.
Her ex-son-in-law. So that all got forgotten because, like, no one talks about that anymore.
And Francis had cut ties with Courtney for a while.
Francis went to live with her mother, Kurt's mother, Wendy O'Connor, for a while. And during that court case that I was talking about with the son-in-law, Isaiah Silva, I think he was a musician too. During that time, Isaiah's legal team, I think, called up Tom Grant to be a part of the case, because Tom had all the dirt on Courtney, like from years and years. And I was hoping that this was finally going to be the linchpin to kind of bring that case up. And a part, if you look in the documents, it actually mentions that Wendy, Kurt's mother, mentions the fact that Kurt's sister Kim brought up the fact that Kurt was killed, was murdered, and that all doesn't get talked about either. So that was in the press for a little while. But yeah, Sam Lufty was this creep that was going after celebrities like Britney Spears, and he's in cahoots with Courtney Love, the queen of that kind of thing, So it just, I don't know. It's a sad story. And even Courtney's father, Hank Harrison, he was a character too. He appeared in that movie, Kurt and Courtney, as well. And he's accusing his own daughter of having Kurt killed too. But his
He has a
word is
bunch
kind of
of.
weird, because he was accused of giving Courtney like LSD when she was only two, and he was like the first Grateful Dead manager, and they
Yeah,
kicked.
so he has all sorts of like CIA deep state weird stuff like that.
That
Like,
came out too. There was documents, FBI documents, actually at the end of last year, came out that that on his deathbed, the CIA guy that Hank Harrison had known, that Hank Harrison was Courtney's father, the CIA guy in a deathbed confession said that I was the one that was giving Courtney thousands of tabs of acid to hand out all over Ireland and England and things in the 80s to kind of get these musicians hooked on things.
that's the stuff that I think, hopefully the stuff that John Potash said
He
I
did,
could
yeah.
trust, because that's mostly what that tinfoil hat episode was about.
Yeah.
Was about like her like ties to the deep state, maybe it's
Yes.
like some weird
She was in Epstein's book.
MK Ultra stuff. Yeah, and she's been around forever. I mean, if you go back to Sid and Nancy, which I think came
She was
out
supposed to be Nancy at first, and then he
in
recast it.
1980, I think is when that movie, maybe a little later,
1986 it was filmed. It came out 86, 87, yeah.
She's in that movie
Yep.
as Nancy's
Friend.
friend. And
That's right.
then the
Courtney
story,
is?
Yeah.
yeah, Courtney
Yep.
Love's in Sid and Nancy.
I just watched that recently. I missed that.
Yeah, she's like her good, like the other blonde girl. But
Okay.
it's
it's
auditioned for Nancy though. So
yeah.
at first.
And it's kind of known what John Potash says is that she would go to all these, towns. She would, I think she came to
All over
court.
Europe at first.
So all over Europe, she's spreading acid out. And then I guess the program switches to heroin.
Yeah.
And man, that's
She got Kurt hooked on it too.
so she would go into all these markets, Deborah. She would go to a new town. I don't find her attractive. Maybe she was back then. But she would go into the punk rock scene, and she would end up dating like the lead singer of the biggest band in that city. She did it in Portland before she did it in, and then all
Yes.
over the place. She dated like the lead singer of Flock of Seagulls.
Yeah, that's right.
And
That's
in
right.
that tinfoil hat episode, it's like the funniest line of a tinfoil hat I've ever heard. Sam goes, "Man, if you're fucking guys from Flock of Seagulls, your life is really not good," or something like that. But yeah, so she came to Portland, did it, and then she would introduce heroin into these cities that never had a heroin scene, Deborah, and get everybody hooked on it. So.
Kind of like with John Lennon and Paul McCartney, in the mid 60s, like they
Yeah.
were introduced to LSD by some weird guy. I remember that story
And
vaguely,
what we know from
the
reading weird,
dentist.
what we
Yeah,
know,
yes.
it
Yeah.
was their dentist
yeah.
or a
The
dentist.
what we know from weird scenes, Deborah, is that the Grateful Dead quite possibly could have been like the CIA house band, which was used to spread, with Timothy Leary to spread, who's, you can listen to Jan Irving. He talked, he's done good work on that, even though he's a total prick, but about spreading all this LSD into all these different markets and all over the country.
Yeah, she had an affiliation with Jeffrey Epstein too. She was in his book and she tried to deny it, but she's in there.
Wild. Well, did you come up and then in Soaked in Bleach, they show there's some real shoddy work done by the Seattle Police Department along with the case. Do you think that was just bad police work and laziness and lethargy, or do you think it was a concerted effort to kind of cover some stuff up?
I think all of the above, to be honest. I think most of the police, when they looked at the musicians in Seattle, they looked at them as being, you know, expendable, like just a dead junkie rock star, you know, dead junkie, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, no real compassion. It's like before Seattle's the Seattle of today, and there's probably a bunch of good old boys still working in police work when you're allowed to, you know, go down and rough people up and, you know.
Well, another reason why another reason that they wouldn't want to reopen Kurtz, like they claim to do it in the 20th anniversary. And that was just kind of a joke, a PR thing that was for about 10 minutes where they developed some film that the coroner, you know, took at the scene and everything. And it basically ended up presenting new questions, you know. So
Didn't they move stuff around in there also?
Oh, there's all kinds of things.
There was supposed to be a stool in front of the door. Nobody could have left, but it was like on the other door that was the locked door, but the unlocked door didn't have the stool in front of it or something like that.
You see pictures actually from the police where the stool's in the middle of the room. So I don't know if someone moved it at that point, but you're not supposed to move anything in a crime scene, but they were contaminating it up and down. They were letting all kinds of people come and go and everything. But basically one of the reasons why they wouldn't really reopen it, you know, to this day. So that's why you kind of need the FBI. I mean, you need another agency to be able to take control of reopening an investigation, because they would be liable with all those, you know, hundreds of copycat suicides, and all those families would be able to sue them for shoddy police work. And here's the thing. Here's the real kicker, is that Courtney had connections with a lot of people in the Seattle Police Department. One of them actually ended up getting murdered about 2 months in June of 1994, a guy named Antonio Terry. He was the narcotics detective that was trying to find the source of the heroin that was in Kurt's system when he died. He ended up being executed at like 1 a.m. I think he was off duty and he came upon a group of people that were changing a tire or whatever on the side of the road, like near an off ramp of the highway. And they executed him. And she would use Antonio Terry to bust other, you know, heroin dealers like Caitlin Moore and other musicians in Seattle, like that wouldn't go with the flow. Like Courtney had a lot of people like at her beck and call.
She wield this power? Was it because she had access to money, or?
Well, now that we find out with like we were just talking about, that she had all these like
deep state ties,
intelligence ever. Connections, like it would be very easy for her to you know, to be able to get this thing done or that thing done. And the lead homicide detective Cameron, he was friends with her too, and he actually told her to get rid of Kurt's note from Rome that was saying that he was leaving her and didn't want anything to do with her anymore. He told Courtney that you better get rid of this because it's not going to do you or your family any good. And what kind of homicide detective is going to tell a suspect, you know, a spousal suspect, to get rid of evidence like that? And he ends up getting busted a few years after that for this corruption, where he was actually a part of a case where one of his underlings stole money out of the evidence room for a case. And he convinced the officer to put it back, but they got caught. So before he could be, you know, before charges could come down against him, he was able to have an early retirement, and then he dies like a couple of years after that in a weird way. Same with the medical examiner, Hothshorn, I think his last name, Nicholas Hothshorn. He did Kurt's autopsy, right? He was friends with Courtney, and he was a roadie for Hole in the late 80s, early 90s. And he knew Kurt and Courtney. So what happened with him is after he made, you know, he played along or whatever, he did his part. He dies in a weird bungee jumping accident in like 2000.
I want to know, how does the road manager for Hole become the county
autopsy?
Well, he was a roadie for them. Yeah, he was a roadie for them and buddy with Kurt and Courtney on the in the scene, the music scene at the time.
But
and
then he total becomes
conflict of interest. Yeah.
Then he becomes the county coroner. That's crazy.
From roadie to coroner.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why Courtney was able to have Kurt cremated immediately.
Yeah. My uncle's brother was a roadie for Exodus, and then he went on to become a mid-level motorcycle racer. Like that's the career journey you should have from roadie.
Yeah. Too,
you know.
Well, yeah. There was also allegations that Kurt, and this is this part is really underreported. There was a guy, he seems a little off, but he was a thorn in the Seattle PD's side for a long time. He started a cable access show like within days of Kurt's body being found, and it was called Who Killed Kurt Cobain, I believe it was. He literally just put, that was the title of it. Kurt Cobain was murdered. I think that was the cable access show. So he would always try to get documents, you know, that were redacted, or he would put freedom of information requests in. So I'm trying to remember his name. It was Richard something or other, but he came across documents, something that it possibly happened at the funeral home, where it pointed to that Kurt's corpse was mutilated by the staff and videotaped. It was claimed that his heart was cut out, his hair was shaved off, they carved Pearl Jam into his chest.
Oh,
like,
my
real
God.
And
was it some sort of ritual, or was it like a...
Well, Courtney had claimed that she ended up getting the videotape on her website, on hole.com, on the chat board, which is long since been erased, but people had screenshots back in the day. She claimed in one of her rants one night in like 1999 or something around that time, that, you know, if Kurt's mother ever, you know, found out this, she'd be heartbroken and all this and that. And then by the end of her rant, she basically almost gives it up that she was a part of it, you know, in a way. It was part of like a blackmail scheme for the Seattle PD to shut up because of the Nicholas Hothshorn connection. But I mean, it's hard to really corroborate that because it was only a few documents that this this investigator, Richard, I really wish I could remember his last name, but it's on YouTube. It says, if you type in Kurt Cobain was mutilated, as disgusting as that is, but if you type those keywords in, you'll find articles to what I'm talking about and the YouTube clip. So there was a possibility that Courtney actually had, you know, had things on the Seattle PD too, to kind of, you know, keep them from lawsuits and to keep.
Yeah, you think, you know, she has such loose lips that she would, you know, trip herself up, or they'd want
to. Well, Deborah, a lot of that's an act too, because she would appear to be like all strung out in front of Tom Grant during certain things. And then when he would, you know, when she thought he was not in the, vicinity anymore, she would like snap into like business mode, where she'd be talking on the phone to like her media contacts and stuff. A lot of it's a put on, like she even says in some of the taped phone calls, like, oh, the press will, they'll totally believe me, they always believe me, you know. She basically says that she's, you know,
yeah,
she's running the show.
I started thinking at one point during this podcast, like, and she seems like the kind of person who might have faked ever doing drugs. Like that, yeah, she would, yeah, like, she was, I'm like always there,
like Charles Manson.
That's yeah, that, yes, was like kind of the comparison in the back of my head. Like, you know, I mean, of course, there's nothing to substantiate that or whatever, yeah, but it's just kind of like, well, you're, you know, she was
what I thought for many years.
She's distributing heroin to all these people.
Yes.
How, but yet she's still, how old is she now? You know, like, she's probably pushing 60. Like, yeah, and yeah, you know, is she strung out today? It seems like someone who was like this connected to heroin for an entire lifetime, you know, would still be connected to the heroin. And I, you know, I just kind of don't get that vibe. Just thinking about it.
She slept with a lot of people too, to get, mm-hmm, to certain points. And it actually reminds me of, yeah, she's Ghislaine Maxwell now.
She's 58.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, she's born.
Oh, yeah. Reminds,
yeah, like Ghislaine, yeah. She has like the makings of like a Maxwell.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it reminded me of. And the fact that Courtney's in Epstein's black book, I wouldn't be surprised if Courtney herself was able to, you know, procure, you know, young girls and stuff for his operation, you know.
There's plenty of room for there to be a strong tie there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Crazy.
I wonder if she ever showed up on the flight logs.
That hasn't been disclosed yet because the powers that be don't want any of that to come out, and you don't hear anything else about it now that Maxwell has, like, what, a cushy sentence in a townhouse prison or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
they're not going to go further with that.
Yeah, but, and nobody on the list has been disclosed.
Yeah, and Prince Andrew actually showed up at Courtney's house a couple of years ago, and at like 2 in the morning. I'm not even kidding. You can type that in. You can type that in. Yeah, and you see the there's a picture, and you see, you actually kind of, I don't feel bad for Courtney, but it's one of those instances where you see her face, and it's like, oh my God, she's like, she looks terrified, and he's all like out of it and stuff, and
yeah,
it's kind of, I don't know, it was kind of humorous, but it's all just really sick.
Yeah, it's like when you're somebody shows up at like the cocaine dealer's house at like 3 a.m. when they're not answering their phone, and they're like, dude, I know I do this sometimes for you, but you gotta get, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't have any girls right now. I don't have any 12-year-olds. Prince Andrew, gotta get out of here, dude. You
gotta get this addiction under wraps, yeah, man.
I'm gonna delete my number from your phone.
Well, if you look back, the guy that you were, one of the guys you were talking about in Portland, I think his name was James Moreland, I think, from his band was called The Falling, Falling something. I don't know. I should remember. It's in Kurt and Courtney, actually. They interview him, I think.
Uh-huh.
He goes on about how, you know, she was trying to groom him to be like the next big rock star in the 80s during the glam metal stuff, you know, the glam days.
Yeah.
And he goes on to say that she would hire like thugs to beat him up whenever he wouldn't fall in line with what, you know, she wanted him to do this or that. And the last thing he says in his interview in that movie is that she killed their unborn child, like did it to herself. And that's in the movie, like in his interview, where she basically killed the child that she was pregnant with. So that just shows you, I mean, if that's true, that just shows you, you know, the type of personality, you know, and that, and he says, you know, in that interview, you can tell he's like, she killed my child, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, it was his child?
Yeah, it was, she was supposedly pregnant.
And with this guy.
This guy that was, that she was kind of, it was a pre-Kurt kind of thing. She was trying to groom him to be like the next rock star in the 80s. Before she entered, years before she met Kurt,
so he was like he was a butt rocker, like before grunge.
It was like a glam, like the glam thing where he dress up like, yeah, yeah. You remember, like, butt, yeah, they look like, yeah.
So she had all this power and influence, yeah, going way back.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
There were even things her father, I believe it was her father that mentioned that she would sleep with like army generals and military figures.
It has all the markings of like, yeah, a Kathy O'Brien, like,
yes,
MK Ultra sex kitten type deal.
Deborah. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. I mean, he was probably trafficking his daughter, right?
Yeah,
probably. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the key to it. So you think if I talk to John Potash about her specifically, you trust what his research says about her?
Oh, I try. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Just it was what he was saying on Donald's I Protest show.
Yeah,
I had to call in because that was like a misconception. The Allen wrench.
Okay, so it's just that thing. Part.
But the most likely candidate was someone that I confronted in Beverly Hills, Callie DeWitt, that ended up getting an art gallery in Beverly Hills. You know, and he didn't come for money. And Courtney gave him a lot of money afterwards to go to rehab. And then she also paid Callie's father, who had a construction company, to demolish the greenhouse like fairly soon after Kurt died. So it's like the crime scene's gone. So,
yeah.
So he was in the house the whole time and he knew Kurt's movements, and he would be, you know, someone that Kurt would be comfortable with in that scenario, in the greenhouse, you know. And a lot of people think that Kurt was surrounded by a few people that he knew, and that's, you know, his guard was down because he had puncture marks in both inside the both elbows. Like, he had puncture marks according to the autopsy that Tom Grant was able to get a hold of,
like track
puncture marks, like someone injected him, like, in both arms.
Yeah,
and the shotgun shell was on the wrong side of the body that it should have been.
Right. Yeah. And he had so much in his system that he wouldn't have been able to hold a shotgun.
Yeah, three times a lethal dose of heroin that would have put him immediately to sleep. And there was no fingerprints on that, legible fingerprints on the shotgun, on the shells, on the pen that was sticking through the so-called suicide note in the planter pot. And that's the other thing. Rosemary Carroll, I'm going all over the place, sorry. Rosemary Carroll actually invited Tom Grant to come over to her office because Rosemary had Courtney's backpack that she left behind. And inside the backpack, because Rosemary was so suspicious of the whole thing, there's handwriting practice sheets.
Yes, that's right.
That's inside the that's thing. Right. And they took pictures of that. And they had some experts, and they do it in Soaked in Bleach, the new movie. They have like handwriting analysis, and it kind of lines up to everything there's a few lines at the very bottom, not the body of the letter. The body of the so-called suicide note is like a retirement letter to Kurt's fans. So they think that Kurt did write the majority of that, which doesn't refer to suicide. It just refers to leaving the music business. But there's a few lines at the very bottom, and the first line at the top to his imaginary friend from childhood, Bada, because Courtney had a flair for, like, you know, the dramatic, obviously. They went and took those lines, and they added up to the different letters on the handwriting practice sheets. So a lot of people didn't know about that either. Like, why does she have all these different, like, it's different ways to write uppercase A, lowercase A, like all these different things. And I read a book called Cobain Unseen from like 2006, 2007 by a guy named Charles Cross, who was basically on Courtney's payroll, basically, because he wrote a book that was supposed to be the definitive biography of Kurt Cobain. And it was all he was buddies with Courtney, and it was all her point of view and all these lies and things that, you know, she could control the narrative, you know. But what he said at the end of this book called Cobain Unseen, which was made up of mostly photographs of Kurt throughout his life, Charles Cross writes at the end that he was able to look at the suicide note himself that Courtney led him. And he was describing how much pain Kurt was in and all this and that, and how it looked like, you know, the last few lines written were pressed down really hard because Kurt was so filled with angst and all that. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, could it be him filled with angst, or could it be Courtney very carefully trying to trace like those letters on to make up those last lines on the note, you know, because I've never heard anyone else mention, you know, that, because he basically, this Charles Cross guy, basically says like that it was printed down so hard onto the note that he was so filled with angst and he was ready to die. Like, the guy knows he's, you know, like the guy's inside Kurt's mind or whatever. It's a bunch of BS. To me, it seemed like he's basically saying that it was pressed down really hard, which in my mind is like someone trying to, add, what's the word I'm looking for? Someone that's trying to like take like tracing stuff, trying to trace these letters on under the, that's what stuck out to me. But yeah, there's so much evidence, man. Like even the shotgun, there's questions of whether or not the shotgun was too long. Kurt wasn't exactly a really tall guy, so some people even think that like the shotgun, the barrel was like just too long for him to be able to reach his hand all the way down. But
We had to use his toe.
yeah, that's what they always
yeah, and
say
guess
from like
what? The pictures they developed, he has his Converse are still on.
guys
So
wearing
some
those
people tried to
Converses
say that.
everybody had in the 90s.
Yeah, and his hair was, here's another thing. His hair was neatly combed. He had a shotgun in his mouth. His hair is neatly combed, according to the electrician that found his body, because Courtney had been trying to get the body found for days by contacting the electric company to go up to find his, to put in a security light. And she was so adamant about the security light and this guy finding something up there. You know what I mean? And eventually he did. A guy named Gary Smith, he worked for the electric company, and Courtney was adamant about them, going up and putting the security light above the greenhouse where her husband's body would be found. You know what I mean? His hair was neatly combed back. And here's the other thing that points to the fact that he wasn't alive when that shotgun went off in his mouth. There's hardly any blood anywhere. There's a little bit of blood they said that was coming out of his ear. Just a little bit. That points to the idea that his heart had already been stopped. Because if your heart's stopping, then you're gonna have blood everywhere, right? If your heart is already stopped, then that would make sense that there'd be only a little stream of blood coming out of his ear. That was it. And Courtney painted a gory picture all over the media about how his head was blown all off, blood and bone and brain.
But if that heart's not pumping when the head's blown off, it's not going to be the same show, that's for sure.
That's what I'm saying. But she tried to paint it in the media that it was a grisly mess. I mean, for her daughter to hear and see years later those reports and everything, like what kind of, I mean, she was really trying to
Monster.
push this suicide thing because she actually planted things in the press for the whole time she was with Kurt, saying, "Oh yeah, he's, he could kill himself any day." There's something that they call a suicide trail. Like they'll start talking about how their spouse is like, so depressed, and I'm surprised he hasn't tried to kill himself yet, and all these things that they would say, because then later on people could just point to like this article or that interview or that this or that and say, "See, she was talking about how he was suicidal back then, so of course it had to have been a suicide." She's very clever in that way of planning a suicide trail. And that just like when she made that false claim and called the cops to say he was trying to kill himself by barricading himself in the room. And then they ended up coming and he's sitting outside smoking a cigarette saying, "No, I was trying to get away from her. She's a nutcase. I'm scared of her."
Good
That
God.
also painted a picture that, wow, he was already made a suicide attempt there. And then when in Rome, when he actually wrote a note saying, "I'm leaving you." Then he gets roofied and has champagne, which he didn't drink alcohol that much. And he didn't like champagne, apparently. The first thing he said when he woke up from his coma in Rome and he saw Courtney, the first thing he wrote down on a piece of paper when they gave him like a pencil and a pad or whatever was, "Can we swear on here?" He's like, "Fuck you." So he knew something. He knew Courtney has something to do with the what, why he was in a hospital bed all of a sudden, And the thing that people think that, even people like Tom think that Courtney was acting more and more frantic in those last weeks of his life is because she thought that Kurt was going to start regaining memories of what had happened to him in that hotel room in Rome. She was afraid that he was going to remember that Callie and Pat Smear, one of his other bandmates that Courtney basically made him, add to Nirvana's touring band.
Yeah, he's from the Germs.
Smears. Oh, yeah, Smears. Yeah, the Germs. Pat Smear from the Germs. He was in the room too at one point, and it was Callie and Francis and Courtney, and then Kurt just, She didn't call the ambulance for 3 hours, I think. It was 2 or 3 hours. She let him just be unconscious on the floor because she was waiting for him to die. So eventually
monster.
she had to call the ambulance because then it would really look bad. But for 2 hours, he's on the floor unconscious.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, so there's a lot there.
Yeah. Well, we've had you for a long time. We've gotten into some deep stuff that I didn't know about. I'll get you out of here on this question, and you can speculate as much as you like. That's what we're all about on this show. Is so it's you know, it's the big, I guess, if you were just looking at it in a regular, normal, not conspiracy theorist way, who was entertaining that maybe he was murdered, is that Courtney Love had him murdered because he was planning on leaving her to, and she was going to be written out of, you know, she wasn't going to get any money from him. She was going to be written out of the will, but if she took him out at the time that she did, she would still benefit from his estate. So is that it? Or is there some deeper, esoteric, weird, deep state
Some,
deal
yeah,
to
I
it?
see what you, I know what you mean. There's some researchers that point to that. The fact that, yeah, Kurt, what his political views, viewpoints, and that he was a pretty far left guy, as it were, that possibly, you know, like a John Lennon type, a voice of his generation, that, you know, he had to be taken out. I leave room for that. I'm not saying this or that, you know, I don't know. Because when you get things like the later scandals throughout the 90s, like would he have spoken out about it like John Lennon would have spoken out, you know, with things like 9/11 or even like, you know, Oklahoma City hadn't happened yet, you know, all these different things. You know, would he have been a truther? Would he have been a Sandy Hook's hoaxer? You know, would he have been this or that? That's a possibility. I mean, a lot of people think that Courtney was like a new Yoko Ono because there was a lot of evidence that, you know, when John was away from Yoko during his famous Lost Weekend, which I think lasted like 2 or 3 years, when he was with a woman named Abe Hang, and that's when that was the famous story
Bad yellow
where
fever, bad.
well, that was around the time when John actually saw the flying saucer in New York City, like outside his apartment window. It was with May Pang, and he actually wrote on one of his album covers, the inside, the liner notes, he wrote about that, seeing the UFO in New York. So during that time, Yoko ends up coming back, you know, and taking John from May Pang and conveniently getting impregnated like right away with Sean, and all of a sudden now John is back on heroin again after being with, you know, not on heroin with May Pang for a while. It was kind of a similar situation when Courtney started dating Kurt. Kurt wasn't a heroin addict, and then all of a sudden now he's got a heroin addiction, and Courtney gets herself pregnant like almost immediately after starting to date this guy. And she played on his background because in his background he came from a divorced family, right? And it was devastating to him. So he said he wanted to do the right thing, and that's why he ended up marrying her at all, is because she was pregnant with his child. And that's what sucked him in, you know, that's what basically sealed his fate. And just like she had done with that other gentleman that was a singer, that he claimed that she killed their unborn child, you know, after Courtney realized that he wasn't going anywhere when it came to, you know, status and his band and everything. He stopped wanting to be a singer and everything because he didn't want to deal with her anymore. So what had happened was basically, you know, whether, I mean, it's on record that she was passing out LSD all over the place, and why a CIA agent that was friends with her father would be supplying that. I mean, like you said, you look back at the work of Dave McGowan or John Potash late afterwards, even Don Jeffries brings it up sometimes. Actually, not so much. I think I opened his eyes to a lot of that stuff too, because he's not really into Nirvana or Kurt Cobain, so he didn't really have a reason to look into it so much as the earlier stuff. But to answer your question, which I haven't yet, I think David Geffen had something to do with it. Obviously,
Ooh.
because he ended up having he had communication that whole time too when Kurt was missing. So he had communication with Courtney as well during
Were
that
they
time.
On Geffen Records?
Yeah, that was the thing. Courtney's band Hole, their album came out a week after Kurt's body was found, and their album was called Live Through This. So a lot of people think that if had Kurt lives and got custody somehow, because she would have made it really hard for him to get custody. She would have made up all kinds of dirt. That's why she wanted the most vicious divorce lawyer that Rosemary could find for her. And the other thing is people think that Courtney hired Tom to get dirt on him, like with, because she kept saying that Caitlin Moore, the heroin dealer in the area, she kept mentioning to people that Kurt was having an affair, when it was actually the flip side. Courtney was sleeping around with everybody, like Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins, Evan Dando from Mudhoney, I think. Like, she was sleeping around with everybody. And she ended up, after Kurt was cremated, she ended up having a teddy bear stuffed with his ashes. She has all these lurid pictures taken, like in bed with Billy Corgan and the teddy bear with Kurt's ashes.
Have you seen,
I'm like,
seen
wait, all this after Billy Kurt's Corgan. Death?
Have you seen all this Billy Corgan stuff that's going on
right I now? Had heard a little bit, but
so apparently they came out with a new album and they're like making the, I mean, Billy Corgan, like, is, I thought he was hated because he's like a right wing guy. He's like super into like wrestling and stuff now. He owns a wrestling. And he was on InfoWars. He talks about, he says he saw a shapeshifter at like a Hollywood party. He said he saw like a lizard person. But he was
went
just,
all David Icke.
And he was just on some late night show. I don't know if it was Jimmy Kimmel or what, but they're playing their new single and he's wearing like a mechanics jacket and it's got like a just a full-on square and compass Masonic logo on it.
Wow.
Like not even hidden, just right there, just big
right there out front.
Right on his chest. Yeah,
well, he I'll tell you, he wrote her album after Live Through This, and a lot of people think that Kurt wrote most of Live Through This, because there's actually tapes that got leaked to the radio stations over the years where you hear Kurt has tracks on them where he's singing.
Crazy.
There's a bunch of them. So they, you know, I think she even wanted Heart-Shaped Box, the Nirvana song Heart-Shaped Box. And Kurt, that was one of the only times Kurt was like, you know, go fuck yourself. That's my song, you know? So I don't know. A lot of people think that had he lived, her star wouldn't have kept rising like it did, because she became like the rock star widow. And then that's kind of around the time she started, you know, wanting to become an actress, and she dated Edward Norton and drove him nuts for a long time. And she dated this person, that person, you know, she tried to, you know, make her, she'd go on Howard Stern and she would like sit on his lap, and she'd sit on Artie Lang's lap, and, you know, she'd have all these, you know, fiasco moments. And then she would fight with Dave Grohl and Chris Novoselic, the other members of Nirvana. And she actually, was in a court battle with over the rights to the Nirvana's music with them for a while in like 2004, around that time. And around that time, I'm trying to think, I had something here. There's a lot of money to be lost had she had a divorce from Kurt. And like I said, she was furious about the fact that he turned down $10 million to headline Lollapalooza 94. And he also,
that's a lot of money.
He wanted to do like a Johnny Cash thing where he'd just go on like these little, he'd go around these little, doing these little tours with an acoustic guitar by himself. And in Rolling Stone magazine, right before he died, it was officially announced that Nirvana had broken up. And a lot of people don't remember that either. And of course, there's also the rumor that he was going to go make music with Michael Stipe from REM, or Michael Stipe was going to have something, that he was going to have some kind of influence on like the next Nirvana album, where it was going to be more of like a white album type thing.
And Courtney had some relationship of some sort with Michael Stipe
for years. Yeah. For years, and I feel bad because I mean,
Michael Stipe was a heterosexual.
I don't know what kind of relationship it was, but they had a relationship.
Am I pulling? Is this a false memory? Is he Francis's godfather?
No, but Courtney tried to push that Marlon Brando was her grandfather for a while. Yeah. To this day, we don't know. Kind of like how a Barbara Bush, some people thought
Aleister was Crowley.
Aleister
Crowley's. Yeah, that's yeah. right. Yeah.
Crowley's exactly, daughter. They look exactly the like same, man.
Yeah.
They
that
do.
That timeline lines up.
They do look the same.
But yeah, that's yeah, pretty much
and then,
it.
I mean, yeah, he was 20. He was 27 years old too, right? 27 club.
So they put that. Yeah, they tie oh, that shit. In there. Yeah, the 27 club and Dave McGowan of all people, he was asked in an interview like if he was going to do a Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon like part two that would have dealt with like the punk rock, you know, time
oh, man,
period.
I would have loved that.
And he said he was interested at one point that he was interested in looking back into that, but he had other things he wanted to cover too. Like he put out Wagging the Moon Doggy. He was looking into, he was doing a series on the Lincoln assassination. So he had other things he wanted to tackle first. And he, unfortunately, in my opinion, he was taken out way before his time too. Yeah, and fair. He wasn't able to do that, but John, people like John Potash and Donald Jeffries, they were able to kind of take up the mantle with a lot of the same kind of work that Dave McGowan was doing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
This Kurt is Cobain, awesome, Chris. What a great story, man. This went so many different directions. I loved it all. This was fantastic. tell if anybody wants to like really start getting into this, what are some good resources? So, like a couple of the books you mentioned and of course Soaked in, watch Kurt and Courtney. And then watch that one first, and then watch Soaked in Bleach. And then what are some good books to check out?
Well, I'd say probably the one that you had mentioned, Drugs Used as Weapons Against Us by John Potash. Okay. That goes into a lot of the intelligence agency stuff that Dave McGowan started with the Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon.
And I think there's a documentary by the same name by him on Amazon.
He did that too, yeah.
But I think maybe I saw it on Amazon a long time ago. I watched it and it might have gotten taken down. So look for that too.
Yeah, he did that. And like I said, a good introductory would be Ian Halperin and Max Wallace's book, Who Killed Kurt Cobain? That was like the first one to really open people's eyes. They did a sequel book in 2004, Love and Death, The Murder of Kurt Cobain. Tom Grant finally was able to actually make a little bit of money in the end by putting out a book where he had the co-writer was the actual guy who wrote it, but yeah, Tom worked really closely with him. I think it was Murder at Lake Washington, I think. Or now I'm going to screw it up.
The wrong resident of Lake Washington got murdered, in my opinion. The other guy that's still around should have gone out.
So I think it was Kurt Cobain, Murder or Suicide, You Be the Judge, I think was the subtitle. So if you look that up, that's a really good one because Tom actually divulges who visited him at his Beverly Hills office around that time, you know, looking for dirt for Courtney, and it was Pat Smear.
Oh wow!
He says that Pat Smear was in tears because he said he was scared and he was in, you know. And Tom said, "Well, if you're not going to help me right now, I'm not going to help you either. You know, if you're going to sit here," and he goes, "I know you're just fishing for, you know, for Courtney right now, like on what I know or what I have." And Pat Smear left the office in tears. And I guess Tom had a heart for a little while because he never told anybody that until this book, which was like 2018. So he felt like he was in the right because Pat Smear, you know, never spoke out about any of it, and he didn't do the right thing. So that's it. For years, people said that it was Dave Grohl that went and visited Tom, and that's what I actually thought for a long time, but I guess Dave Grohl gave the thumbs up on stage once in an early Foo Fighters concert when someone yelled out Tom Grant's name. I guess Dave Grohl gave the thumbs up. And I think Howard Stern even asked him, Dave, about these accusations around that time, and Dave didn't really say anything. He was pretty tight-lipped about it.
Yeah, but, Isaac Weishaupt has done some good work on Dave Grohl and Foo Fighters and stuff. So
I always thought Dave was a pretty cool guy, but then when I hear about like with the vaccine stuff, like and doing the concerts and making the fans, you know, take the thing. And
He made
then
his
the
drummer.
weird
He's
way
made his
Taylor,
made his made his drummer take it.
yeah, which is fun, which is ironic because in the early 2000s they did an anti-vaccine series of concerts. If you go and look that up, that's back in the day, and like they changed their stance, you know, pretty quickly in 2020.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's pretty much it. I mean, there's like Soaked in Bleach. I've been talking back and forth with the director of that documentary, and he's supposed to come on my show eventually, and he's going to bring with him a lot of stuff that he wasn't able to fit in the documentary, which gets me really excited because I guess he had a lot of stuff he had to cut out to make like the time frame for the documentary. So I'm wondering what he has in store, you know, for when I'm able to talk to him. Because in Soaked in Bleach, one of the last things I'll tell you, in Soaked in Bleach, they had a phone call between Tom Grant and Courtney where Courtney says, and I hadn't heard this ever anywhere, Courtney says, I think Callie was in the house and heard the shotgun go off and got scared, and that's why he left. And you never heard Courtney talk about, you know, Callie being in the house or any stuff like that before. So when she says that, it's almost like she's pushing the blame off onto Callie immediately with Tom. You know what I mean? So she knew where Callie was. She knew where Kirk was. And
yeah,
there's a lot there for people to go. It's fascinating, even if you're not a grunge fan or music fan. If you're a fan of Cold Cases and, like, you know, staged, you know, I don't know why you'd be a fan of it, but if you're interested in the idea of staged suicides with, you know, being murders and things, there's a lot there.
Yeah. And
yeah, there's a lot here. This is, it's almost a side note that it was a famous grunge band that's involved, you know?
Yeah.
Because Tom Grant himself was not, he didn't know even know who Kurt Cobain was when she hired him.
But it's if you're an elder millennial like Chud or a Gen Xer, it was you know, it was a big deal. It was a big deal for our
like
for
John
our generation. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right on. Anyway. Well, that if you get that guy on to for an interview from Smoked and Bleach, that's going to be fantastic. So keep us in the loop on that one. And
yeah, he's working on another movie right now, so he doesn't have a lot of time. But he did get back to me last week, and he's still interested. So.
Rad.
Cool.
Tell everybody where they can find you, Chris, and we'll get out of here.
Well, I'm on Twitter. I think it's my handle is C Graves Mass Guy, GUI, because before it used to be C Graves Mass Hole, and trying to get guests for a podcast. I mean, I can't really ask Squeaky from, you know, I got, you know, a curse in my handle, so So that's where I'm at there. And I, like I said, I have a podcast called Get Mad with Chris Graves on Ocelli.com that I do every Sunday at 8 p.m. And I'm actually the co-host with Tony Arterburn on the show Paratruther that comes out usually once a week. But we have one coming out soon on the Denver airport.
Yeah. And you're very heavy in the Billy Ray Valentine, Don Jeffries, Tony Arterburn sphere, which I love to hang around in. And it's a real honor to be able to be a part of. So
lately I've been hanging around with the new Prisoner podcast with Six and John Henry there. And there's a guy named Gary McBride basically the four of us go over the news every week. And we've been working on the documentary on the January 6th prisoners that haven't had even a trial date or anything.
Yeah.
No, so I've been working on that too. And it's been an honor, seriously, to be here with you.
Yeah. We'll get you back sometime soon. Let us know what you want to talk about, and we'll get you on here. A fantastic researcher, and keep sending me all that. I don't read them all, but keep sending me all those, all those Twitter articles, man. Cause we'll need them when Deborah and I start getting into it.
Unhinged.
Yeah, unhinged. But thanks again, Chris, and let's talk soon. All right.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you
Chris.
So much.
Great. Take care. Right. You guys really have good. A great night.
All right. See you guys.
Nice meeting you.
Bye.
Nice to meet you too.
Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people or those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass to lay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And I want you. and all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots, playing God all day, deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that seven-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.